passage says, وَتَنَزَّهَ عَمْ مُجَانَسَةِ مَخْلُوقَاتِهِ. تَنَزَّهَ means he is clear. It is far from Allah. Allah is glorious. Here it says transcends. That could be also a good translation. وَتَنَزَّهَ عَمْ مُجَانَسَةِ مَخْلُوقَاتِهِ. Transcends from congeniality with his creatures. That means that Allah is nothing like his creatures, the things that he has created. لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٌ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْبَصِيرُ. So we have a body, we have a physical body, we have hands, we have eyes, we have imagination, we have anything that we can describe for ourselves. Allah is above all of that. Subhanallahi amma yasifun. Subhanallahi amma yushrikun. When the Christians, they said, Allah has a son. Allah has a son, Jesus Christ, which is completely false. Allah says, Subhanah. That means he is clear from such attributions. Subhanahu idha qada amran fa innama yaqulu lahu kun fayakun. It's very easy for Allah to make a human being to be born from a mother without a husband. It's not difficult for Allah to do that. He can make that happen because Allah is capable of everything. We are just the means of Allah. So, my dear brothers and sisters, when we think of Allah, when certain thoughts cross our minds about Allah, we have to know that Allah is a lot greater than those thoughts that cross our minds, because he is not like us. He has created everything. He has created matter, he has created ghaib, the things we see, the things we don't see, spiritual things, material things. But he is above all of that. He has created time. Allah existed before anything called time existed, before we could say past, present, and future. Allah existed before that notion even, because this is what he has created, and that's why we say that he is above everything that we can imagine. Tanazzaha. He transcends from congeniality with his creatures. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and protection of Allah. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
see. For no one knows but you and me.
Good night to all our dear listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Very nice to have you with us. I'm hosting you for the next hour. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Youth Station. The program is all about young people and addresses topics which are all related to young people. Our varied radio productions feature will follow. And after that, it's time for Minbar. The program covers speeches on a host of subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Stay with us for the next hour.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. I am a Muslim.
Islamadi,
Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon
Him. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you, and here with me I have the pleasure of being with my very dear sister
Masuma. How are you?
Great. How about you?
Everything is nice.
Well, these days my friends are just talking to me about getting married.
Yes.
And why do you make a stand against it? Why don't you like to let someone enter your private life?
Mm-hmm.
Well, to answer them, I have many things in mind. But honestly speaking, I just act as if I haven't heard what they say.
Oh.
Because I know that they're not going to be listening. They're going to have their own side. And I do have mine. And this is a place that we cannot have any common things in between. So I act as if I couldn't hear. And they're sometimes like, hello, girl, are you still here? And I'm like, I am here. I heard all you said. Even a few days ago, I told them the summary. I told them, you said this, 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 and that.
I remember it all.
And I heard all of them. And even don't imagine for a second that I couldn't hear. I heard them all. I just chose to act as if I cannot hear. I chose to be deaf at the moment. So, single life. This can be the starting point of today's episode.
I think when every generation looks back on their older generation,
yeah,
they take away some messages. And I don't want to say something very too much general. Generation have seen, unhealthy marriages around themselves,
yeah,
or are in movies and stories. So, you know, when I hear some lady, for example, you know, when women get together, they nag. I'm like, girl, so why did you get married in the first place? Like, and, you know, they're like, oh, I wish I knew why you didn't do more research. So I'm always blaming them.
Yeah.
I'm like, why didn't you think beforehand? Why you didn't do this? Why you didn't do that? And so now that I'm the age that I might get married, it feels weird that should I stay single? Should I change a bit? What's going on? We are in this little confusion because we don't want to risk. We have this sense of individuality. I think back then, especially when people lived in joint families,
mm-hmm,
this sense of individuality was not really there. It was more that us. It was not me, right?
Right.
I hope it can make sense. It was, how can I be benefit for others? But now, at least some people like me in our generation are like, how is it gonna benefit me? We are more I-centered.
Yeah, right. But I think with improvement comes this kind of vibe that I have to care about myself.
Yes.
That I am responsible for my own life. I mean, in the past, we would have had these stereotypes that the man of the family is going to be,
mm-hmm,
responsible for everything.
Yes.
And the woman is going to just stay home, be gentle, take care of the children. And now these roles have been deleted.
Yes.
So as a woman, as a man, I know that I am responsible for myself. Boys right now will say that I will leave once, so I should be responsible for whatever decision I'm making. The same happens to the girls. So I think with improvement, these things have come. Parts of them are positive even. I mean,
yes,
it's really nice that a young girl today will not wait for someone to come and just...
Oh, a lovely prince to save me.
Exactly. And the boys the same. They are not waiting for someone to come, change their lives, make it more beautiful, make it all colorful and nice. But they are working for themselves. The boys know what their dreams are and they're working for it. The same happens to the girls. But the way it has been connected to marriage, this is a bit more complex. It is a bit more complex and confusing, I guess.
Yes, because this has so many aspects to it. It has, you know, as I told you, this individual aspect of it,
yeah.
Personal, and then social, how society is. Some societies, you know, make marriage as a pressure.
Yeah.
For
a must.
Yes. It is a level that is, you know, you have to do it. And then some people are avoiding it because they don't want to say yes to the social pressure.
Right.
While I think that if the social pressure was not there, these people would, you know, would prefer to get married even. Which is like really interesting how we react to different topics because
of society.
Yeah,
sometimes you just don't want to accept the norms of the society.
Yes. You want to be the rebellion.
But going back to our religion, it is really nice that in Islam we have this idea that marriage and men and women standing next to each other
mm-hmm.
will complete them. Our great prophet had said, marriage is my tradition. Whoever rejects it is not from me. So we know, I mean, as Muslims, we know that this is a must. This is something very important. This is going to improve us. This is going to be our final decision. But then we come to this point that, am I ready for it or not? I mean, for Muslims, I guess,
mm-hmm.
the problem is here. This readiness, am I ready? Am I well prepared to go for this decision or not?
Back then, when I think, you know, this knowledge and psychology, this were not really common, people would make mistakes and they would think that a certain age
yeah.
means you're ready.
Yeah, they
now,
had.
We see child men, as some friend of mine called them. That is really pathetic and bad. What? Now that we have, you know, thankfully, we can have, you know, therapies, knowledge, we observe other people, we can make a bit wiser decision. And if you're not sure, just reading some books and getting a therapy can really be helpful.
So we have to go for this. We know that our religion is just encouraging us
yes.
to get married, to start families, to share this wisdom of the Islamic culture within the community.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go for a short break, and then we're going to discuss what are the deeper reasons for young people who reject marriage.
Is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Some people like to be independent.
Yes.
Like to have their own freedom. And they are scared, like me. They're scared that what if the person who's going to enter my life will change? I have seen many people around me, many
yes.
friends, that once they were marrying, they thought, okay, this person is different. He's different from
the
world.
He's
the
one.
Yeah. He's the one that I could find. And then they go for the marriage, and after a few months, the challenges will start. That one person will change into the common one, into the kind of one that, the kind of person that could have come to their
that
life and change
scary.
Everything, or even destroy. So many people are scared of this, that people will change, and what if my independence, my freedom, will make him sad or make him change his ideas towards me. The same will happen to the boys. What if the woman is going to control me so much that I cannot have my freedom to spend time with my friends, say it?
Yes, we have seen many examples around ourselves
yeah.
that this makes this lovely concept of marriage very scary.
Yeah.
You know, see, I understand why society kind of puts pressure on young people to get married. Because a healthy, good marriage, I want to highlight healthy, good marriage, huh, can really help you improve. You know, emotionally, spiritually, and worldly too. But not every marriage is gonna, you know, give me this growth.
Yeah, right.
Some marriages destroy you, kill you. And not only you, but also your children, if by that time you have children.
Even your family.
Your families and surrounding. And then, oh my God, these toxic families all together. Now, amazing, we have a small back society. That's not nice. That's one of the big reasons, I think, why our generation does not want to continue the cycle. They're waiting for this perfect marriage.
Yeah, right. And they're not ready to take risks.
Yeah, no risks, exactly. We are not ready to take risks. I'd rather die single, probably, than take risk of a, maybe, you know,
also
marriage.
Also, financial problems. I mean, for boys, I have some cousins mm-hmm. that are just at the age that they have to, they don't have to, say. They want to get ready to start a family.
Okay.
But whenever we talk to each other, they have this phobia, this terror that, what if this happens and I'm not ready financially to start a family? What if I will not marry unless I am sure that one day my wife wants something mm-hmm. and then I can just provide her with it? What if I do not have that much of wealth that is needed for her?
In Islam, we believe that yeah. rizq is something that Allah gives us. So, you know, we can try our utmost, but at the end of the day, Allah is the one who is blessing us. So for this particular, you know, aspect, I can be a little gentle and say that mm-hmm. we can, you know, if you're working, if you're, you know, doing enough, then you should not worry that much.
Yeah.
You should have a bit tawakkul to God.
But putting it into practice is hard.
Yes, of course it is hard. For me, I see marriage a bit scary, not for the financial reason.
I think the biggest problem, I mean, the most highlighted one, mm-hmm. based on the community, the society, what I can see with people, is this fear of conflict or divorce.
Oh.
I mean, we don't like the negative side. We don't like the other person saying negative ideas about us. We don't like them to criticize us. And more importantly, we don't like the divorce. So because this young generation doesn't want to hear the negative idea, negative side of the story, doesn't want someone to come home one day and say, why did you do this?
Mm-hmm.
So they escape it. I don't know if you've heard any stories or seen any people experiencing this problem, that they don't like to be in a conflict. You know, our generation usually likes to be in comfort, in quiet and peace.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel marriage is going to put us outside this peace.
Yes.
We're going to be outside this comfort zone.
It is definitely going to be out of our
yeah.
comfort zone because, you know, even normal relationship like friendship needs a lot of sacrifices,
yeah, right.
Let alone this marriage that you need to, you know, get along with a totally opposite gender from a totally different family and probably from a totally different universe. Of course it's scary. But
so I think this is the scariest part.
Yeah. That you wouldn't be able to, you know, have that spark for the longest of time.
Right.
That connection that we thought that could comfort each other. Because we have in Quran that in Surah Ar-Rum, verse 21, He created for you from yourselves mates that you may find tranquility in them. You know, if there is no peace and calm, why to get married? Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah, so truly mentioned. And also with companionship, with this being together, this togetherness, comes this peace, comes this tranquility, comes this connection, this vibe that I'm not alone. So marriage does have its terrors, let's say, its risks for sure. But also with it comes the stability and love. With it comes the companionship that we might never find anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for sure, with our family, we feel safe. We feel like we have some supporters next to us. But this level of connection is totally different from
the
other
ones. Yeah, it's a different type.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we would want to get married according to social norms, it can be very hard because society has some very unnecessary taboos.
Yeah, right.
And very hard
and
norms,
traditions
and standards for both men and women. I am not saying
right.
It's very much easier for men or for women. Both sides, they have to be this perfect woman or man to be, you know, wanted. And these labels that people are putting on each other. The best thing I think is to, you know, trust God and reference to the religion. What has religion to say? Are these norms even acceptable? Are these even important? What is the main thing that I should be looking for? What sacrifices should I make and what sacrifices I should not make?
Also looking at the other side, I mean, okay, you prefer to stay single your whole life. Is this connecting your religion? Is this connecting your personality and your character? You know, humans are created for connection.
Yes.
We are created in societies. In our religion, we have many places like the Friday prayer. We have many places that we show.
Communal activity.
Yeah, exactly. We show that we are standing next to each other. We show that we're not alone. our religion is not the one that has been designed for people being isolated
yes.
and all alone. So our religion is showing the way. The risks are of course on our way, but we should also be aware that we're not going to stay alone our whole life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even possible.
So I think we should go for marriages, but if you are aware, ready, and, you know, strong enough.
Well, with the wishes of great marriages in the way of our listeners, and with the wishes of great lives for those who are already living with each other, let's end today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
George Galloway, thank you very much for doing this. I'm sitting in London, in the city of London right now. I'm an American. You're a citizen of the country I'm sitting in, but you're not in this country. You're in another country. Why are you there, and when are you coming back?
Well, it's a long and difficult story. It started last month when my good wife and I were detained but not arrested by the anti-terrorism police at Gatwick Airport in London. Now, ponder that piece of Kafka-esque framing. You are not under arrest, but you are not free to leave, they said, these pistol-packing anti-terrorist cops. They said you have no right to silence, and if you refuse to answer any of our questions, you will automatically be guilty under the Terrorism Act of an act in defiance of that very serious act. And the policeman joked, good luck ever getting on an airplane again. Now, to complete the framing, I'm 71 years old, 7 times elected Member of Parliament, a member of the British Parliament across 5 decades, the leader of a British political party, the biggest broadcaster in Britain, not nearly as big as you, but the biggest British broadcaster in Britain, broadcasting to the largest audience every single week. I'm one of the best known people in the country, and I've got armed anti-terrorist police telling me I'm not under arrest, but I am not free to leave. And of course, it quickly turned out that the purpose of the pool, the detention, was speech. My podcasts, my broadcasts, my tweet output, my Facebook output. That's the Britain that we now have today. And we spent 4 hours in my case, 5 hours in my wife's case, in 2 separate rooms, surrounded by armed police officers, being questioned about our political views. And in my wife's case, her fingernail, which is painted rather nicely in the Palestine colors. Now, if you had told me 8 weeks ago that such a thing was even remotely possible, I would not have believed you. There is no more patriotic British citizen than me. In the last decade, Mr. Carson, I fought 2 major battles for the British state. 2014, The Spectator said, my speeches saved the Union when Scotland's separatist referendum looked very much like it was going to succeed. And 2016, I was one of the leading figures in the Brexit movement trying to win Britain's independence. And so here I am, sitting in a police station in Gatwick Airport with armed men questioning me on my political views. So the trauma of all that To be honest, being outside of the country is the least of it. If I tell you, and nobody knows this except you and me and whoever watches, it literally broke my heart. I now have a cardiologist. I'm a man who never lost a day through illness at work in my entire life. And now I have a heart condition, arrhythmia, which the consultant cardiologist, a very fine one, tells me is of recent provenance. So you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out that these cops actually broke my heart.
First of all, let me just commend you for your very long string of good calls. You were against the Iraq War, you were against Scottish secession, and you were for Brexit. So I don't think there are many people who can say they were right in all three. But I'm confused as to why a 70-year-old former member of parliament would be considered a terror threat. And what was the pretext for doing this to you? Do you know?
Well, the Terror Act, through which I sat in its passage and opposed it every line, precisely because of the possibility of its abuse in this kind of way, allows the police to seize your documents, seize your telephone, your laptop, seize everything, only at the port. They would need a warrant to do it anywhere else in the country, and they'd be very unlikely to get one in regard to me. But they saw the opportunity of stopping me under that act and divesting me of my whole life, everything, my parliamentary correspondence, my legal correspondence, my personal family pictures, my political correspondence, the members of my party, the membership list of my party, and they took it. And this is precisely the abuse of the word terrorism that you saw in London yesterday, where old ladies, old men, people in wheelchairs, blind people, are being arrested under the Terrorism Act for holding up a placard, a little piece of cardboard at their breast, and they are being taken away under terrorism charges. This is the nightmare that is Britain. Your stature will definitely not be a cause for your being huckled in the way that I was. You are a very big global figure. They wouldn't dare to touch you to get your telephone, to get your laptop. But if they could even do it to me, then I ask you to ponder just who would be safe in Britain from that. So to complete my answer to your first question, I'm not going back to Britain until I know that that will not happen again, not least because of the health problem that it has given me after the first time. And they will not give me an assurance that it will not happen again. And if you think about it, why would it not happen again? Because it happened because of my broadcasts and the fact that the British state and the Stumer, Keir Starmer, who leads it for the moment, at least, don't like what I say on my podcast. Well, I'm still broadcasting every Sunday and Wednesday, and I still have the same point of view. So there's no guarantee whatsoever that the same thing wouldn't happen to me again. My wife couldn't sleep or eat for weeks after it. She's already thin. She lost 10 pounds nearly in weight as a result of the trauma of this occasion. We knew that it had happened to other people, but we didn't think that we would be regarded as other people because of the position I have over 50 years in politics in Great Britain. But it did happen, and it could happen again.
What did they accuse you of doing wrong? Had you called for armed insurrection against the Starmer government, or what was their claim?
No, I don't even believe in that, never mind call for it. I believe in democracy. I believe in freedom of speech. That's the problem. We are governed by a prime minister and a pygmy cabinet, which rubber stamps every cockamamie scheme he has to take us into war with Russia. Now, I don't want to go to war with Russia. not for Russia's sake, but for Britain's sake, for the sake of the British people, whose blood and treasure would be burned, and the British people, whose country might disappear into cinders and ash underneath their feet if such a war were to take place. So the proximate reason, insofar as one can glean it from 4 hours of circumlocution, is that I oppose the British government's policy towards Russia. Now, I might be right on that. I might be wrong on that. But as John Stuart Mill points out, if you deny a point of view the right to be heard, the loser is not the person with that point of view,
yes,
but the rest of us, because we will not hear what might actually turn out to have been good advice. But that's not the way these social democrats, Christian democrats all across Europe have put the lights out on freedom of speech, lights out on democracy. They're interfering in elections. They're canceling other people's elections. They are throttling free and independent media. They are bankrolling stooge media to try and crowd out. They are threatening the social media platforms with sanction and even closure if they don't kowtow to the prevailing orthodoxy. And I'm afraid Britain is in the vanguard of all of that. And I make this point. I'm not saying this because I hate Britain, yes, but because I love it. It is an ache for me to be outside of my country all of this time. I have children there. I have a house there. I have a very keen addiction to the English Premiership in football, soccer, you call it. I'm torn from all of that. I'm torn from my family and friends. So it's a dull ache for me, but it's not as painful as another armed arrest by the anti-terrorism squad would be. So for the time being, it looks like my wife and I are around the world in 80 days and then
Has anyone come to your defense? And anyone with authority in Great Britain? Anyone in the political classes? Anyone on television? Anyone?
Yes, and the most surprising people. People like Lord Hannan, Daniel Hannan, when he was the leader writer for the Daily Telegraph at the time of the Iraq War, I cost his newspaper £2.1 million in libel damages. But that didn't stop him taking the principled stand of denouncing this misuse of the word terrorism, this abuse of the anti-terrorism legislation to impound a prominent politician for nothing other than expounding, he said, his abhorrent views. And that's a real measure of a believer,
yes,
in free speech. And there were one or two others on the other side of the political aisle from me, but not that many from my own side, because my own side, the so-called left, which is really now just liberal, Americans don't get the difference, has drunk the Kool-Aid of the Ukraine war. They appear to be going quietly into the potential good night of nuclear war. Well, I will not. I will rage against that dying of the light.
What's so remarkable is you became famous as a leader in the Labour Party, as a big figure in the Labour Party. I know that you were kicked out 20 years ago or so over your opposition to the Iraq war. But, I mean, just listen to your accent. Everything about you says old-fashioned Labor Party. How weird is it to see that party that you grew up in and worked for become a kind of spokesman for war and international capital and, like, everything I thought they were against?
Well, as you know, this is the era of cross-dressing and political cross-dressing more than any. The left are now the warmongers, and the peacemakers, so far as they exist, are largely to be found on the right, particularly in the United States, particularly, if I may say so, in your own person. The truth is, the right wing, slightly unhinged, president of the United States is doing everything that he can to stop a war in Europe. And the Europeans, social democrats and Christian democrats alike, are determined to stop
yes.
him stopping the war, to continue the war. That's the ultimate cross-dressing, it seems to me. I grew up in an era out on the streets protesting about U.S. wars. Now the U.S. trying to stop the war in Europe, and the people who would once have been demonstrating with me, alongside me, are the ones demanding that the war should continue.
I follow this as closely as an American can, but trying to be honest here, European politics is not my politics, and it's confusing, despite, you know, however hard I've tried to understand it. And I don't fully think I comprehend why nations that are beset with systemic and very serious problems, including economic problems, that don't have meaningful standing armies, they can't prevail if they were actually to fight Russia. I mean, of course, they would lose. But why would they want to? Why are they dead set on war with Russia? Do you understand the motive?
Well, you know, there's an old First World War truism. We're here because we're here. And ultimately, we'll be here to guard the graves of those that were here because they were here. It's partly that they have dug themselves, I don't want to get Shakespearean, but they are steeped
yes.
in blood so far that it is a genuine question whether it's bloodier to go on or to go o'er. And they have spent so many hundreds of billions of euros, pounds, dollars of their people's money in a forlorn charge of the Light Brigade that it's fatal for them politically to admit that they were wrong, that they misused all those funds and they caused the deaths of all those people for no reason. And so it seems to me it's partly that. Don't forget, Mr. Carlson, these people are at rock bottom in public opinion
yes.
approval rates. Keir Starmer's currently at 10%. 10%. Only 19% of the people actually voted for him a year ago and a bit ago in the general election. But now it's down to 10. Macron is at 11. Merz is at 18. They couldn't muster a majority if you put them all together. And so what choice do they have? It's continue to reinforce failure, to continue to throw good money after bad, to continue digging, even though they know they're in a hole. So I don't know what choice they really have. The question is, bigger question for me, is why are the media, as they still describe themselves, not holding to account? You mentioned that you first knew me and didn't like me because of my stand on the Iraq war. I was on the BBC every single day
yes.
in the run-up to the Iraq war, right throughout the war and for many months after. Virtually every single day. I haven't been on the BBC for 10 years. The mass media, as they still call themselves, though, the real mass media is you and exponentially less me. But the people who call themselves the mass media have entirely given up any role that they might have had to hold to account the political leaders for making decisions that are manifestly not working. An American leader said just yesterday, forgive me, I didn't know him, forgotten his name. He said about the European Union's 19 sanctions packages against Russia. He said, well, if you've tried something 19 times, you've got to admit you've failed already. And yet they are currently planning a 20th round of sanctions against Russia. And I didn't properly answer a point you made earlier. These societies, one of which my own, are not just economically failing. They are culturally and socially
yes.
disintegrating. Hatred, racial hatred, fear of immigration, large-scale immigration, collapsing birth rates, demographic time bombs. Our societies are the very definition of sick societies. So what are we doing about it? Well, we're were sending uncounted and uncountable and untraceable billions to the little chiseling crook in Kiev.
It seems like suicide to me.
Yes, it is. It's self-harm, now headed for suicide. And by the way, it's no accident that amongst the sicknesses in our society is the drive towards state-assisted suicide. Keir Starmer has spent more time in Parliament this parliamentary term piloting a scheme by which you can shuffle your old grandmother off to a pod provided by the state, give her a glass of sherry, and put her in the pod and say goodnight. We in Britain have now a 42% abortion rate. Almost every other baby is aborted. And we're shuffling off granny. We have a demographic nightmare. And pornography everywhere. Gambling everywhere. Everybody is sponsored by one gambling. You know, I'm so old, my father used to have to slip a piece of paper on a street corner to a bookie's runner to put a bet on a horse race. And the runner had to literally run in case the police saw him to a Britain where gambling online, offline, in every high street is practically the only economy we've got. How's that for a sick society?
I just wonder, I mean, I just have to pause and say everything, it's just so amazing to hear you say what you've just said. I've never heard a British politician talk about any of those things. And those are meaningful to me as someone who thinks that human beings have souls and human dignity is, that's the project we're engaged in. You know, how do we improve people's lives and make them more fully human, not extinguish those lives? You're the only British politician I've ever heard say anything like that ever in 50 years of watching this country pretty carefully. Why? Why is that? Why are those issues never addressed?
Well, we haven't just lost faith in this country. We deride faith. We mock it. We even criminalize it. We've had people arrested for praying the rosary outside of abortion clinics in Britain. People like me who believe in God are regarded as freaks by the liberal establishment, the liberal prevailing orthodoxy. And as Dr. Johnson said, the prevailing orthodoxy is the grimmest dictatorship of them all. And indeed it is. And anyone outside that prevailing orthodoxy is called a freak, called a phobe, called an ist, and banished and silenced. If it wasn't for social media, nobody would have heard me for 10 years. I would not have been on the mass media. By the way, in that 10 years, I've been elected and re-elected to Parliament, but they still would not have heard me. Social media has given me an audience sometimes of double figures, millions per week. One week, 13.5 million in 1 week. Again, nothing like your numbers, but in British terms, massive numbers, far more than any BBC program or Sky News. But I have to do it all. My wife and I, a mom and pop podcast, broadcast, and look where it got me. When my numbers grew so alarmingly that the state realized that actually not only was I continuing to speak, I was reaching more and more people, they sent the police to Gatwick Airport to not arrest but detain me and seize all my material. That's a measure, I think, of how dangerous the independent man or woman is.
I watched what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. I was never a Labour voter or sympathizer, really, but I was struck by, and I'm not a friend of Corbyn's or anything, and it's not my job to defend him. However, I noticed the unfairness, just the sort of transparent unfairness of the attacks against him, and that piqued my interest. Why are they calling this man names that clearly aren't true? And it seemed obvious, again, from across the ocean just watching, that this was the kind of last step in converting what was a workers' party, a labor party, into a neoliberal banking party with the foreign policy and social policy to match. That was my read of what happened. Is there any chance that you could return from exile and take it over and return it to what it was, a pro-Britain party?
I don't think the Labour Party can be saved. That's why I lead what we call the Workers' Party of Britain. We got 212,000 votes in 150 constituencies. So if you gross that up, we would have had 1 million votes. We didn't win any seats, but we came second in several, all of which were currently predicted by the opinion polls to capture. So you can't rule out new developments. And Mr. Corbyn himself is next weekend forming another party, though it's beset by wokeness and division and ultra-leftism, left extremism. He's already having trouble staying at the helm of that new party, and it isn't even founded yet. But there's the Greens, who are the ultimate in greenery, quackery, and wokery, but they're doing quite well. So I think the next election, if Britain survives, will be a parliament, a balkanized parliament. The nationalists, separatists will have another go, and this time they may very well succeed. The Greens, socialist parties like mine and others. But the main winner will be reform. Nigel Farage is currently on track for an absolute majority in the next parliament. But I'm sorry to tell you, you probably like him more than I do, and I worked hard with him in the Brexit campaign, so I know him up close and personal. He isn't the answer either. He has a shallow political outlook which depends entirely on the race question, and the race question in Britain can never really go anywhere. First of all, the ethnic minorities in our country are very, very much smaller than they are in yours, and in any case, white people will soon be an ethnic minority in your country. That's not the case in Britain. Britain is an 88% white country, and that's not going to materially change. So if you try to frighten people into believing that Britain's problems are the fault of Abdo, who owns the local shop on the corner, or the fellow who you buy a piping hot curry from on a Saturday night in the high street, you're really not going to be able to solve the problems. Because if you remigrated, is the new vogue word, if you remigrated every person of colour in Britain, well, first of all, the English football team would crash out at the first round of the World Cup in the United States next year, but the economy would collapse, the health service would collapse. It's very heavily staffed by people who you count on to save your father's life when he gets carted in with angina on a gurney. So it'll never succeed. And if that's your only club in your golf bag, then you are merely setting yourself up to fail. And all of the other prescriptions that Nigel Farage has are all tired, clapped out, Thatcherite solutions, which weren't solutions then, and they definitely ain't now. So, in short, I'm saying we are in deep trouble.
I hope that if you ever leave exile, and I hope it's sooner rather than later, you will come to the United States and stay in my house. You are always welcome. George Galloway, who I've admired, I didn't even know how much we agreed on, but thank you very much for doing this, and Godspeed. Me too. Thank you.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's now time for a short lecture by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani. In this session, he delves into the teachings of the book for the Hadith by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This book is a profound exploration of ethical and mystical concepts in Islamic spirituality. Let's listen and reflect together.
We had ended our discussion or left our discussion on the topic of at-tawbah from the book of Imam al-Khomeini. Then he starts to explain about how tawbah is not this simple thing that we have heard of. Tawbah is this really important thing that we do. Of course, for us, tawbah, usually, it refers to a simple idea of us raising our hands and saying astaghfirullah. And we assume it's that simple and that easy. The reality is there are two different aspects to the tawbah that the human being does. Two different aspects to what we call a tawbah. Recite a salawat, please. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad wa ajid. There is the outer aspect of tawbah, and then there is the inner aspect of tawbah. The outer aspect of tawbah is very simple. All it takes is a couple seconds. All it takes is enough decency to repent to Allah, to apologize to Allah. All it takes is astaghfirullah. And in fact, what our narrations teach us is that you don't even have to say that. Even when you want to repent, even saying something is not needed. The narration says, before the servant of Allah even opens his mouth, because Allah knows he's going to repent, Allah forgives him before his lips start moving. So this person is already forgiven. This is the outer aspect of at-tawbah. This is the outer aspect of al-istighfar. And in our communities, in our culture, in our understanding of Islam, this outer aspect of at-tawbah and istighfar, instead of making it easy and simple, we've made it difficult. What do I mean by this? The understanding is, tawbah is for that special night of the year. Tawbah is for Ramadan. Tawbah is for Muharram. Tawbah is when you have that moment of closeness with Allah that might come once a year. But in our Quran and Hadith, it's far more simplified than this. In Quran and Hadith, this process of doing tawbah is far more simplified, meaning it's something that's supposed to happen constantly. It's not supposed to be something that you make such a big deal out of it, you have to wait 6 months or a year to make it happen. No, it's something you have to do quickly. You yelled at your wife, you yelled at your husband, now's the time for tawbah. You don't have to wait Ramadan comes. You don't have to wait Jummah comes. You don't have to wait for you to see some sign from God. It's always surprising for me, in the culture that we have, many of us will commit sins, including myself, and then we'll sit there, and we will wait for some special sign from Allah to tell us we have to come back to Him. Why do you need a special sign from Allah to tell you to come back to Him? Why do I need to maybe open the Quran? We've heard stories like this, yes? You have to open the Quran and all of a sudden a verse shows up and you connect with that. Why do you need that? There's already 6,000